And welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's once again time to welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio. He'll field all of your astronomy-related questions. He is one of the best-known and most widely read astronomers in the world. Bob is a great guest here. He can translate very complex things into things that you can understand, however, things that I usually don't understand. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, you can also tweet us with your questions, WAMC Vox Pop, WAMC VOXPOP, that's one word, or on Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio, and our producer, Patrick Donges, we'll bring the questions in as they come. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here, Ray.
So, you know, the new old Farmer's Almanac is out for 2013, and you are you're right here. They describe you fully. Well, you know.
I haven't seen yet. What does it say?
It says that I lost your bio page, but you're right at the top. But let's see. I lost it. But, you know, I was reading this, and I don't know exactly how much you have to do with the astronomy section.
I write the whole thing.
You do. Okay, so what I found fascinating, I turned to page 90, and it's the title of the page is The Twilight Zone. Learned something I never knew. Twilight to me was always this subjective thing. Well, the sun is down, but there's some light. Now, apparently, something I didn't know, it's very precise, and there are actually three different twilights.
Right, that's right. Even legalistic, because if things happen in one or the other and people are culpable, it can even result in court action. Yeah, three different kinds of twilights: civil, nautical, and astronomical. And it's not defined by time, but by how far the sun has plunged below the horizon. The first one, civil twilight, the brightest, begins at sunset, ends when the sun is 6 degrees down, usually about half an hour. And you can still see colors. Things are still pretty bright. At the end of civil twilight, according to most municipal ordinances, streetlights have to be on.
Oh, interesting.
Now, the next one, nautical twilight, is so named because mariners at sea, at the end of that, they lose the horizon. You can't distinguish a horizon from the sky. So you lose your reference bearings. Things
okay.
are really murky, and I can tell you colors are also gone by then because the eye cannot see.
So that's below 12
colors.
Degrees?
Exactly, 12 degrees down. And happens at different seasons. They last different lengths because in the winter, the sun plunges down faster. Also in the tropics, the sun drops much faster. And in higher latitudes, the sun is slithering into the horizon at a skinny angle, so it doesn't get down very far. So even an hour after sunset, you can see it. And the third final twilight is when that ends, the sky is fully dark, the faintest stars are out, and that's why it's called astronomical twilight.
So really, for our perspective, astronomical twilight is the same as night.
As night.
Okay. And in the Farmer's Almanac, on page 90, it'll actually show you the length of astronomical twilight if you need to know such things.
Cool.
Fine work there, Bob.
Thank you.
Let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. We go to Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
Oh, hi. What I had a question about, the Russians had... were experimenting or investigating a lake somewhere, Siberia. I don't know where it was.
I think it was Antarctica, I believe.
That's another one.
Okay.
This is one that they had, they knew was fresh water, that it was a million years old, and they didn't know what would happen when they hit the water, whether they'd have a big geyser or... Anyway, they were testing for any possible life. But I never heard anything. Any follow-up after that. Have you heard anything? I mean, I think there's another one going on in Antarctica. Maybe it's the same one.
I know the Russians are drilling, and I forget the name of the enormous under ice lake that's there, but they were drilling, looking for microbial life.
Yes, it's really outside my field, so I can't help you with that.
Oh, well, okay. I was just curious whether you had heard if they hit the water or not.
Oh, interesting. No, I have not heard that, but thanks a lot. You know, I think probably where that is going is, are they going to be able to find life or the building blocks of life on some of these iced over moons of Saturn. Is it Saturn?
Right. Saturn has one, Enceladus, and yeah. Jupiter has at least one that's lots of liquid salt water, warm salt water under the oceans. That's Europa, so that's very exciting.
Yep. Let's go to Roger in Albany. Roger, you're on Vox Pop with Bob Berman.
Yes. The previous gentleman perhaps is referring to Lake Baikal. It's in the southern part of Russia, Siberia. It contains one-fifth of the world's fresh water. Gigantic, and it's about, I don't know, 600 feet deep or something, and the water is crystal clear.
All right.
But I'm just fascinated by so many things with astronomy. In my old age, 62, I'd like to go back to school and take a course in cosmology. Several things fascinate me. The Chappelle supercluster, maybe comment on that. Also, I've heard a new theory called multiverse. Whether that has any validity or not, I'm certainly fascinated to think about. So I'll turn down.
Okay.
Welcome your...
Okay.
Great. Well, Bob's a big fan of multiverse.
I'll just first say that super clusters of galaxies are discovered periodically, and this one is a new one. I don't know anything specific about this, but ever since... this past May, when the Berkeley team announced their findings of 900,000 galaxy clusters being surveyed, pointing to an infinite universe, it's almost the whole picture that's grabbing our attention more than any particular supercluster. As for the multiverses, the reason Ray said that is that we're in an odd time now in cosmology, where unlike 15 years ago, where we really thought we were closing in on understanding it pretty well.
And the theory of everything? Was that called the theory of everything?
No, it's different. This is cosmology, essentially the study of the universe, and theory of everything, which is a silly name. First of all, it's just another name for trying to find a grand unified theory that ties together all the forces, all the particles in the universe. String theory, for example, is trying to do that now. Since then, discovering that most of the universe is dark energy and dark matter, finding that the universe is probably infinite, and discovering how little we know about the Big Bang and evidence that's pointing to it being just a local event in the hood, not the birth of the whole universe.
Right.
Almost as a substitute for that, cosmologists, each one of which often has a book to write or a theory to put out or something new to say. And the real problem is that we really have an absence of data. We don't have a lot of hard data right now. And so we're groping around in the dark when it comes to cosmology, unlike other areas of astronomy where we really know a lot of stuff. And multiverses is one of the speculative ideas that you can't even call it a theory because there's not enough data to support it. The idea that there's different, you could almost say alternate realities. It's just a throwback to something that was being said in the 70s and 80s, where we thought that one-dimensional strings were connecting our universe from other universes that were also inflating in parallel to ours, each one of which could have different properties as well. But because it's so speculative, there's... I think nothing that's being said along these lines now will be believed to be true in 10 or 12 or 15 years from now. So it's kind of it's almost head trip activity.
Right, and it's really not provable at this point, right?
That's right.
Okay, so let's go to Richard in New Baltimore. Richard.
Hello.
Hello.
There I am.
Yes, you am.
Well, thanks for... I have a question, let's say, relates to the nature of nothing. And I heard you say the magic word, and that is dark matter.
Yes.
My question is, sort of basically, what is it and things about it? Does it have mass and gravity and a charge? Is it in motion? What's the story with dark matter out there?
That's a great question, and it was brought up in 1933 by Fritz Zwicky, who first noticed that since we're in a cluster of galaxies, the other members of our cluster, called the local group, not a lot of imagination in that name, they could use a few poets, on the naming committee of the International Astronomical Union. The other members of our group, which include Andromeda and the galaxy M33 and a lot of dwarf galaxies, are all moving at such a fast speed that we all easily should be able to escape from the gravitational clutches of the collective. But we're not. We're hanging together. So even back in 1933, Zwicky realized that there's at least six times more gravity here than meets the eye. And by meets the eye, we later found that even if we add all the black holes we can think of, all the nebulae, all the collapsed stars, anything that we can think of, there's still at least six times more gravity. And later we found that the way our own galaxy spins is weird. It doesn't spin with the outer layers going at a slower speed the way our solar system works, where poor demoted Pluto takes 248 years to go around the sun, while Mercury swiftly goes around in 88 days. No, our whole galaxy spins like a pancake, like as if it were solid, with almost no differential spin at all. And this, too, indicates there's at least six times more gravity than all the stuff can explain. So what can we do with that? The only thing we can say is that there is some unseen entity that seems to pervade the whole universe that we call dark matter. We know nothing about it except that it doesn't give off any light. We know that it can't be too concentrated in individual spots. In other words, it couldn't be black holes, because that would influence the rotations or the revolutions of nearby stars around it. So it's sort of like an amorphous, almost all-pervading thing. And the best guess is that this is a new kind of subatomic particle that can't be seen, that has no visible entity at all, but exerts a strong gravitational pull. And that's pretty much all we know about it right now.
Hey, Rich Guthrie, shouldn't you be preparing for the next bird show?
I'm always ready to go. I'm prepared.
All right. Well, as you well know, right around 20, we take a break. So we'll talk to you when you get here for the next program. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and we will take a short break. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551, the number. More calls coming up.
Support comes from HMT at the Spa Little Theater, announcing their 28th season beginning October 12th with the musical 9 to 5 in the Saratoga Spa State Park. HomemadeTheater.org. The Blue Bonnet Diner, Northampton. Since 1950, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner, banquet facilities, seating 150, banquet menus, bar services, and dance floor. BlueBonnetDiner.net. Berkshire Classic Leather and Silver, Lennox. Featuring travel wear luggage by Briggs & Riley, silver jewelry, leather jackets and coats, and accessories by Brighton. 413-637-0727. The Phantom Gardener Nursery, Rhinebeck. Encouraging sustainable gardening with plants, fruit trees, berries, and organic supplies. Organic from the start, sustainable for the future. ThePhantomGardener.com. And Dr. Johanning, Capital District and New York City. Specializing in occupational and environmental health and prevention, including back disorders, water contamination, new technology, and mold problems. JohanningMD.com.
And if you're scoring at home, Rich Guthrie's bird program here on Vox Pop will be Thursday, September 27th. So mark that on your calendars. Rich will be back with us on these airwaves if he doesn't call in with another question before the show's over. Bob Berman is our guest today, noted astronomer. Bob, you have something that you've done for a long time, but you don't talk all that much about it.
No, that's right. Once every 2 years or so, we offer a sort of a four-session astronomy, you couldn't call it a course, maybe a workshop would be better, on Friday nights at the observatory just outside of Woodstock. And I've never mentioned this on the radio before, but I thought our listeners, give them a shot at coming, because we explore relativity and explain quantum theory and the nature of light and color and have a lot of colorful things, not to mention the big telescope where you have to actually climb a ladder to use it.
So this is the old kind of, the old school telescope.
Oh, yes. And so people who are interested, it starts at the end of September. I'll just mention it once now. You could go on the website, skymanbob.com.
.com,
or give a call and leave a message at 845-679-0785.
So it's a four-week program.
Four Friday nights, starting September 28th.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Maxine in Monroe. Maxine, you're on.
Hi, Ray and Bob.
Hi.
My comment or question is about the Mars rover Opportunity, and that it was said that when it would be moving, it would be going 1.5 inches per second. And at the time, you know, I was thinking, okay, that's not a whole lot. And the reporters were sort of acting or commenting like, you know, if you looked away from it for a while and you looked back at it, it wouldn't be going anywhere much. And I started figuring it out, and it can go quite a distance, you know, that in an hour it would have gone 450 feet.
Yeah.
And now how long is a football field?
300.
Then it can go further than a football field in an hour.
Well, that's about the same speed that the Giants receivers
all
went
right.
last
you know,
night.
All right, enough shots on the Giants, Bob. I've had quite enough.
Good.
Well, that was the old one, of course. That was Opportunity. Now we've got Curiosity, which is better in every
That's
way.
That's what I mean. It was Curiosity that they were disparaging would be going 1.5 inches per second.
Yeah, no, that's fast enough. Remember that there's a lot of work to do. It's going to be there for years. And now that we've got an RTG power source instead of those solar panels don't work that well on Mars because it's 1.5 times the distance from us, so the sun is 1.5 squared times fainter. Plus, Mars is so covered with dust and dust storms that the solar panels got covered, and the electricity stopped after a year or two.
So what's RTG?
The RTGs are so cool. They're radioisotope thermoelectric generators that convert plutonium. Not every one of our listeners is pro-plutonium, but it converts plutonium directly into electricity. And by doing so, it'll have a power source that will last for decades, that will never diminish, or at least not along the life of the spacecraft. And there's plenty of power for doing all sorts of cool things, including roving along the surface of Gale Crater and all the rest.
Well, Maxine, thanks a lot for the call. Now, our producer, Patrick Don, just every now and then would like to throw me a huge curveball. And so he just came in while you were speaking and gave me a 3-page press release from Indiana University, dated today. Indiana University mathematician offers unified theory of dark matter, dark energy, altering Einstein field equations. I'll read you the first paragraph, and then I will glaze over and hand you the paper. Bloomington, Indiana. A pair of mathematicians, one from Indiana University and the other from Sichuan University, have proposed a unified theory of dark matter and dark energy that alters Einstein's equations, describing the fundamentals of gravity. And it goes on and on from there for about 40 paragraphs.
I'd love to see that.
Here, I'm handing it to you now.
Because dark matter and dark energy are so different from each other, it's like saying here's a theory that's going to unify celery and burglars, you know, things that have no relationship to each other. Well, actually, they do because they would both have some form of RNA or DNA, I guess, in them or cellular structure.
Yeah.
But in this case, dark energy is one thing, dark matter another. I'd love to see this thing because considering that we have no idea what either of those things are, I don't know how you'd unify them.
Well, I tell you what. You know what? When we take our 40 break, I'll give you 90 seconds to read that over, and then you can comment on it. What do you think about that?
I'll try.
All right. Let's go to Peggy in Queenman's Hollow. Peggy.
Hi. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think at some point Bob was saying that time was either non-existent or relative. Given that, how does it affect the concept of speed, since time is a component of speed?
Well, big question. Well, speed, you could say, is simply motion, something that moves from here or there. Time is what we do as human beings. In other words, more and more people are thinking that time is really nothing more than a sense of animal perception, where we try to make sense of the almost overwhelming barrage of electrical impulses and inputs that we have in our brain, where we see an object, and then we see it in a different spot, and we see it in a different spot. And so we have this idea of time as being some kind of matrix in which things move. But physicists more and more don't believe in the existence of time. It doesn't exist as a separate item. You can't take it to a lab and analyze it like cottage cheese. It's a perception thing, not an actual thing. So very few physicists now, you know, it never had a function in Einstein's relativity, in those equations, in Newton's laws, it's except as a change. You know, as you write it with the word delta, a change from one thing to another. And that's a little different. That's motion is different from time.
But isn't speed how long it takes to move a distance?
Speed is motion. Now, you can have something that seems to move slow and something that moves fast. What we do with it in our minds, we say, okay, how far has that gone in this amount of time or in this amount of time? And so we conceptualize it. We put a category, a label. We make sense of it. We make mathematical sense of it. But it's something that we do with the moving universe. Maybe I can make this clearer. Consider our brains, where untold electrical activity is going on with 100 trillion synapses at all times. Now, this is activity. This is constant activity, so you could call it motion.
Yeah.
But is this really related to time? How would you put time into the brain, you see? So this is merely how we make sense of things when we choose to.
So it's an artificial framework, essentially?
Yes. Space and time are both tools. They're tools of animal perception.
Okay, so the next time I'm late for work, I'll try that. It's an artificial framework. Listen, boss, we go to Kemek in Pittsfield. You're on.
Kemek? How about Kermit?
Well, I got a K and an E and an M and an I and a K. How are you? Kermit.
Good afternoon, Mr. Graf.
Hey.
So listen, you know, while I've been sitting here and listening to the show, weren't Bob and Ray the two personalities for that old Utica Club commercial back from the 60s?
Yes, those guys were great.
You guys are better.
Well, thank you very much.
So this is for Professor Berman. So I know that your expertise is in solar matters, or at least your interest is there. So my question is, I realize now that Voyager is about ready to leave our solar system. And if I can rely upon some of the news reports, I think, if I understand correctly, Voyager really is right at the edge of our system. And my question to you, Professor Berman, is, assuming that other solar masses in the universe are similar to ours, and I'm not so sure that I understand that they operate on the same fusion as does our sun, and perhaps you can explain that, how will Voyager tell us, by what measure or standard, that it has gone into the grasp of a new solar system or other similar environs after it has left ours and left intergalactic space? And I would like to hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay.
If that's okay.
No, it's a great question.
Thanks, Kermit.
Right.
Appreciate it.
And you put a lot of questions in that one question, so let's dispense with the thing about stars. Yeah, most stars shine by fusion, and means they are giving off a stellar wind of broken bits of atoms that stream out into space. Only the older stars, the dead stars, like the white dwarfs, are no longer operating by fusion. And so our sun certainly does. And it's not that the Voyager 1 is way ahead of Voyager 2, so far away that the light itself takes I believe the last figure was 17 hours for a round trip from our radio receivers to these spacecraft, Voyager 1. And it's not that it's ever going to really reach another star. In fact, the closest it's going to pass will happen in 40,000 years from now, and even then it's going to be more than one light year away from the star that it's closest to passing. So that's not the issue. The issue is, when does it leave the influence of our sun? And we're defining the influence as the solar wind, that stream of particles that radiates out from the sun affects us, will give us a beautiful aurora borealis sometime in the next year, and streams out through the solar system. Well, by theory, at a certain point, it should meet the interstellar wind, that is the aggregate leftover material from all 400 billion stars that make up our Milky Way galaxy. They're sending out streams of little particles, too. some of them cosmic rays that actually get here to Earth that manage to overcome the outgoing solar wind. So it's a collision. But when will it push back so much on the solar wind that the solar wind doesn't get any further? The last few years have been very exciting, and the last month has been even more exciting because as Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, also not quite as far out, have gone further and further, the solar wind going past it is getting slower and slower and slower until a couple of years ago, the spacecraft is going at the same speed as the solar wind, and that's not very fast. So we knew we were reaching the end of the heliosheath, which is that boundary around the sun, and very much approaching the heliopause, the place where that solar wind stops and we can say the true interstellar space begins.
Okay.
And we're almost there because those speeds have gone now to nothing, essentially, and it's almost any day now when we reach the point where it comes back the other way and the pressure of starlight, you could almost say, starts pushing back on the sun's influence. And then we know we have finally exited the solar system for the first time.
Now, you mentioned that it takes some 17 hours round trip for signals to get back and forth. At what point will it be so far away that we will not be able to communicate with it?
Well, that's a good question. Even though it's only using the electricity of a refrigerator light bulb, thanks to the big dishes that we have that are tracking it, we've been able to do it. And thanks to the fact that they have those RTGs, both the Voyagers also have these plutonium sources of electricity, and those will keep working. So the instruments are actually still working on this. And that 17-hour figure, don't hold me to it because it's something like that, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
All right, so let's go to Frank in Colony. Frank, you're on Vox Pop.
Oh, thanks, guys. Listen, have astronomers given up on the idea that there's a cycle to the Big Bang? I mean, everything I've seen in nature shows that there's a cycle. Why can't there be a cycle on a cosmological level?
Well, there could be. And at one time, it was a very attractive, I think, aesthetically attractive idea to think of the Big Bang as being just one kind of out-breath, you know, like the Hindu legend of the breaths of Brahma, where the universe expands and goes out and then it contracts again and that it would someday collapse and then rebound. Nobody knows how it could do that, but then again, nobody knows how the first one
formed. I remember seeing something about an article concerning brains, B-R-A-N-E-S.
Yes, that's something else. No, so the idea was that it's an oscillating universe, that it goes in and out and in and out. Brains are one of the many, many ideas. You heard another one earlier in the show. A caller was mentioning something else. The brains means a membrane, that there are these perhaps one-dimensional or two-dimensional membranes in space, and when they collide, it gives rise to things like boom, Big Bangs, and there would be no limit to them. There might be trillions or perhaps even an infinite number of separate Big Bangs, each with different properties and different universes. In other words, our own universe is just one of an infinite number. It's all speculative. That part is speculative. Equally speculative is the idea of whether an oscillating universe is true. Ever since 1998, when we found that the universe suddenly increased its expansion rate,
It
did that about 7 billion years ago, even though we just found out about it around the time we were switching to broadband from dial-up. That's when the news reached us. And from that point on, we had to say, well, if the universe is just going faster and faster and faster, thanks to this outward-pushing anti-gravity thing that we don't know anything else about, that is dark energy, that means it's hopeless. It'll never recollapse. It can't oscillate because it'll never come back together. But then others said, well, because we don't know anything about dark energy, maybe suddenly it will change its properties in the far future and become a pro-gravity thing and pull the universe back together, and it will rebound. So the bottom line here is nobody knows.
All right. Frank, thanks a lot. Let's go to John in, Glen M. Where are you calling from?
I am calling from Glen, which is in Montgomery County.
Oh, Montgomery County. That's what that latter part was. All right. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, guys. And, Bob, I really appreciate you being on the program, and I wish that we could have you on once a week instead of once a month.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well,
I don't think we could afford them.
It. Here's my questions. The last item that we sent to Mars what was that called again? Opportunity?
Curiosity.
Curiosity. Okay, when that was traveling from Earth to Mars, approximately how fast was it traveling?
Well, let's work this out. We send things to Mars on what's called a Hohmann transfer orbit, where we let the object just glide at its own speed. My guess would be something in the area of 68,000 miles an hour.
Okay. Now, I also heard from, not from you, of course, but from somebody else on the news, that that was faster than we could send a vehicle loaded with people to Mars.
Now, I don't know why that would be the case, because what difference does it matter what the spacecraft contains, whether it's oxygen and people or whether it contains the rover that we were landing?
The person who said that the reason was because there would be so much, it would be such a rough ride that a vehicle carrying people would have to go a lot slower than a vehicle carrying instruments.
Uh-huh.
Make any sense?
Well, perhaps the initial blast out of Earth orbit towards Mars may have been an acceleration that would have been uncomfortable. Once you're en route, though, the engines are off, and anybody or anything inside the spacecraft would have would only experience weightlessness. The whole way to Mars, all you feel is weightlessness. So the
How long did it take for the...
About 7 months.
How long would it take to send people to Mars?
Same thing.
Okay.
John,
then I guess what this proves is something that Alan says, don't believe everything you hear from the news media.
Well, we know that, don't we?
John, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take a break here. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. We've got an open line here if you want to check in. 1-800-348-2551. More coming up.
Support comes from Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts. AshokanCenter.org. Lori Stilwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StilwellCPA.com. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, celebrating 30 years of educating children and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Dr. Carol S. Kessler, director, the Erlen Clinic of Kingston, providing back-to-school diagnostics for Erlen syndrome, symptoms including reading, writing, and test-taking difficulties and concussions. 845-334-9340. And SPAC, presenting Saratoga Wine and Food and Fall Ferrari Festival, featuring wine tasting, cooking seminars, and more. September 7th through the 9th, SPAC.org.
One 800-348-2551 is the telephone number here. It is Vox Pop. It is Bob Berman Day, our resident astronomer. He is with us. And so you have read the three-page press release. What do you think?
I didn't read it.
Oh. So you didn't do your homework.
Can I take it home?
Yes, I'll take it home. It's a press release from University of Indiana regarding dark matter and dark energy. And Bob will read it, and then we'll talk about it next time. Great idea. I should have thought of that. Joy in Montgomery. Joy, you're on.
Hello. My question is about the Pleiades. I was listening to Star Watch this morning, and they were talking about mariners checking the Pleiades before they decided to sail, ancient mariners, and I got interrupted. Do you know why they do that?
Well, I don't know who particularly did that, but the Pleiades are that lovely star cluster, often called the Seven Sisters. There's nothing else like it in the sky. And at this time of year in September, around midnight or so, if you look toward the east, you can see it because it looks like nothing else. It really looks like a little tiny cluster of stars, stunning in binoculars, named for the daughters of Atlas in mythology. So even their names are beautiful. The individual stars with binoculars, they look blue. The names are Atlas, Pleione, Alcyone, Electra, Maia, Taygeta, Merope, Asterope. Isn't that gorgeous?
Yeah.
More than seven, because there's a lot more than seven.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And even though they're lovely, they had an evil reputation through most centuries. They were regarded as associated with great loss of life, and even some thought that the Atlantis myth, whether that was given rise to by the great Santorin volcano, the eruption that destroyed what's now called Santorini, it was called Thera back then, and destroyed the Minoan civilization on nearby Crete in 1650 BC. It was thought that the Pleiades were up in the sky when that happened, and that ever since then it's been associated with a great cataclysmic loss of life.
Interesting.
So significant in the American Native Americans regarded it as evil, and the European cultures did too. So it's had quite a run, but truth to tell, it's nothing more than just gorgeous if you point binoculars toward it. And since there's nothing like it in the sky, there's only one little star cluster that's so obvious to the naked eye. It's worth a look. Midnight nowadays, but in the middle of winter, it's up all night from the time the sun sets.
I've seen it.
Wonderful. Yeah. Joy, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll see you. Let's go to Judy in Mount Washington. Judy, you're on.
Thank you. I wonder whether Bob has seen the zodiacal light and whether it's easy to see at our latitude.
Okay.
It's easy only at one time of year, and I want to point out to listeners who wonder, what the heck is that? It's a glow that runs along the zodiac, and because the zodiac often makes a skinny angle from the horizon, it's usually buried in horizon haze. But just at two times of the year, that is in February to March, after sunset, or August, September, that is this time of year, right before sunrise.
I had the date as from the 18th to the 28th, or something, 14th to the 28th of this month.
Well, there's no particular date to see it, except you don't want the moon interfering in the sky, because you need crisp, clear skies that are not hazy in any way. And you need a clear view down to the horizon. It's great from Montana, let's say. During the years I was running the program at Yellowstone for the Park Service, we used to look for it every morning, because from there they're up at 8,000 feet, and the skies are so dry that it would be easy to see. And it looks like a cone-shaped glow of light from fat on the bottom and then tapering like an ice cream cone upward as it goes higher in the sky, almost like a precursor of dawn. In fact, Khalil Gibran called it the false dawn. And
how far up in the sky will it go?
Maybe a third of the way up the sky.
Oh, really?
Quite clearly. In bright,
but not here in the Taconics? Or...
Well, yes. We've got dark enough skies, certainly, and what you need is a real clear view down to the horizon. So at this time of year, you'd want to get up, as I say, now you'd see it in the morning, in the east, looking toward the east.
Yeah.
And if you see a glow that angles up from the eastern sky, up and to the right, that looks like maybe a first hint of dawn, or looks like a detached piece of Milky Way, although it's nowhere near the Milky Way.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the zodiacal light.
Okay.
A very lovely thing.
Judy, thanks a lot. What is it?
It's the reflection of countless tiny dust particles in the plane of the solar system, in the flat plane of the solar system, which when we look outward from the sun, we see it reflecting back to our eyes.
Interesting. All right, Robert and Troy, you're on.
Robert.
Hi, Robert.
My question got to do with Einstein's curvature of the universe, that gravity is not a particle transition, that Earth is like a BB on a deep groove in an old-fashioned vinyl record disc, that gravity is the curvature of the universe and could cause heat, volcanoes, etc., as well as the tides, and that there is no gravity particle. And I wanted your comments on that.
Yes, I will do that. Our friend here who is fact-checking, by the way, going back before I forget to do this, from when we were talking about how far the voyages are, he found that I happen to be right before it's 17 hours.
17 hours.
Travel time.
Okay, so, I'm on a radio signal.
Yes.
Yes,
exactly.
Radio or a light signal.
Speed.
Yes, yes. So so somehow that figure 17 hours actually was correct.
You're right again.
Popped into my brain. But I hate to say anything wrong. That's why I'm glad. thank you for checking up on that. Now, your thing is that light, it does what?
That gravity, not light.
That gravity?
Gravity, the curvature of space, according to Einstein, could cause volcanoes and tides and other things. Like instead of the Earth's center being heated by radioactive isotopes, that the center of the Earth is heated by the gravitational rotation of the Earth around the Sun. So the curvature, the geometry of space itself, causes heat in the center of the Earth without a particle like a graviton.
Well, that's very interesting. I find that very interesting. Certainly, if you believe Einstein, that gravity is essentially geometry, and that what we experience as gravity is the warping of space-time. And that's the superior way of looking at it, even though we don't teach kids at school that that's what's happening. For example, we still tell kids that Earth goes around the sun because the sun has a gravitational pull on us, and this holds us to the sun. The Einsteinian way, as you well know, is the because space-time is warped by the sun's huge mass, it weighs the same as 333,000 Earths, it means that Earth is just falling in the laziest, straightest possible path through this curved space-time. And that curved path, which he called a geodesic, carries us back to our starting point after a year. Plus, and here's where we're getting to your point, everything here on Earth, when we jump up and come down again, that's because of the local distortion of space-time caused by the Earth's mass and our own masses. So everything we see when we drop our keys on the ground, this is all a manifestation. The keys are just really going in a straight line through the curved space-time. Now, with that as background, the caller is suggesting that tides are another manifestation, and so is heat within the Earth. Well, I will say this. The tides are extremely well-known, both the solar and the lunar tides. They are totally understood. And they're understood, of course, by the influence of the of a differential gravitational pull. That is, tides in the ocean isn't caused by gravity. It's caused by the fact that gravity is different on one side of the Earth than on the other side of the Earth. And this difference is what causes tides, not gravity by itself. However, if you just substitute the idea that curved space-time, just use the word curved space-time instead of saying gravity from the sun and the moon are causing the tides, then it would be a truism. Yes, then of course that would be the case. You're just substituting one word for the other. And I think they'd be equivalent then.
All right. Robert, thank you. We appreciate the call very much. Let's go to Stuart in Vermont. Stuart.
Hello.
Hi.
Guy Man Bob, thank you for sharing this great knowledge.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My question is, I've been tracking the sun here for a number of years in Vermont, and I understand what it does seasonally when it rises and sets. Can you explain more about the moon and how that goes through its patterns of rising up to the north and then settling back down to the south and the height of it as it goes through its cycle? Thank you.
I'd love to. The fact is, as Newton's pointed out and ancients even before him did, is the moon goes through a number of different cycles. They are so fascinating, but they're, if I had a chalkboard here and TV, I could begin explaining them. The rough one is that the moon goes around us every 27.32166 days.
Right.
Okay? That's the first. But as it's doing so, its orbit changes its direction. It's not round. It's shaped like an ellipse. And the direction that ellipse angles away from us itself moves in an 8.86 year cycle. So that as the moon wants to come to its closest point, that closest point has moved on after the moon makes one revolution. So the time from the lunar near point or perigee to the next is not 27.32166 days, but 27.55455 days, a little bit longer. And that's not the end of the story either.
No.
The moon has a flat plane that's tilted relative to us. And if you picture a plate that you've dropped on the floor, if it doesn't break, it might rattle around for a few seconds, facing in different directions as it does so. The moon does that too, but in an 18.61-year cycle, but in an opposite direction from the way it's actually moving around us. So that when the moon comes back to the point where it crosses the flat plane of the solar system, it'll reach that next crossing point, which is, by the way, where an eclipse can happen. It can only happen at such a node or crossing point faster than the other lunar month. That happens in 27.21222 days. And I remember these numbers because they're so easy, 27.21222.
Yeah.
Who could forget that?
Yeah, right.
So what I'm saying about this is that even Isaac Newton said that just thinking about the moon gave him a headache. Because there's a lot of things happening at once. So your question, which is so beautiful and innocent and clear and ancient, what does the moon do? How does it move? Is more complicated than at first glance.
Stuart, thanks a lot. You know, the ancients, speaking of the ancients, they figured this out a long time ago. How the heck did they do it?
They had lots of time on their hands. They had no TV, and there was the sky, and there's the moon moving from generation to generation. I will say this.
But if it's an 18-year cycle, I mean, that's an awful lot of watching.
It's true. And because some of these cycles only repeat in what's called a Saros, and you don't see the same thing happening until three Saroses have elapsed, which is 54 years in 1 month.
Yeah.
You have to wonder, how did they figure that was probably longer than an average lifespan back then? How did they get that? That was pretty perspicacious of a lot of these cultures.
Well done. Well played. Bonus points for Bob. Damon in Kingston. Damon.
Hi, how you doing?
Yes. Good, you're on.
Hi.
Okay, well, my question is, I also have an Einstein question. That in the last century, Einstein and Nathan Rosen came up with their, I think it was in 1935, they published a paper on the Einstein-Rosen bridge.
Yes.
And I just wanted to know, what do you think of that? It's theoretical, but two questions. Do you believe that they could exist? And also, if they did exist, would it be possible for us to use technology to open an Einstein-Rosen bridge, or would it be something that just has to happen naturally?
There's a lot of excitement about that in the when I was in an undergraduate in the 70s and going into the 80s. But it's thought now, and it's been thought since then, that such a wormhole, as an Einstein-Rosen bridge is also called, if it existed at all, it would be so susceptible to collapse by any mass at all that if we tried to get into one and cross it, we would cause the collapse of it so that it wouldn't actually be a practical way to get into different places or times. But in theory, such a bridge could be a conduit to either another part of the universe or to another time in the universe, mathematically.
Okay. So something without mass? Thanks a lot. Something without mass, then, for even though light has mass, right? But if you sent light through,
yes,
you could theoretically transmit information.
Well, I never thought of that. That's very interesting.
All right. Well, that's what I'm here for. George in Waverly. George, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Great show. I have, I think, your question related to the previous caller, one of them anyway. So we've heard a lot of buzz about the so-called Higgs boson, which I don't pretend to understand completely, but of course it's supposed to be an explanation of mass. Is that correct?
It's an explanation of why things have the mass they do.
Okay. So at the same time, we're asked to believe that it's mass that causes the curvature of space-time, correct?
That's right.
So what's the connection then between the Higgs boson and Einstein's theories?
Well,
general relativity, in other words.
They're not really related to each other. I'm trying to think of a way in which they would be.
I mean, because of the fact that it's mass that causes the curvature.
Yes, but here we're talking about really tiny bits of mass. This is really a particle physics realm rather than astronomical realm. And, of course, objects in the realm of particle physics have negligible mass. I mean, even a proton, which weighs 1,836 times more than an electron, has no attractive mass. How many protons do you need in order to even slightly pull on something else? So we're not really, the mass isn't a gravitational thing here. It's more like a point of ponderance of why on earth should a proton weigh 1,836 times more than an electron? Why should some quarks be very lightweight and other quarks be heavier than an entire atom of gold? There's no rhyme or reason to it. So the idea, in theory at least, is that there should be some overarching particle in the whole zoo of particle physics that bestows on other particles their mass, and that would be the Higgs boson. So
the point is that when you put together gazillions and gazillions of these little particles to create, you know, the car that I'm sitting in. The Higgs field has disappeared at that point in relevance. Is that the point? Well, in other words, when you get to the large objects, which are just made up of these little tiny things, zillions of them, the Higgs boson field is not
relevant. Yeah, because once you have the mass, once you have your car, you're in your car. You don't need the Higgs to maintain the mass. The mass is there.
All right. It's
why these different particles should have mass in the first place.
I sorry to say we have to stop you guys there. Thanks to everybody who called in today. Thanks to the great Bob Berman for joining us. Good show. And, George, I tell you what, we'll take that one up next time if you call a little earlier. Support for WAMC comes from WMHT Production Services, providing high-definition video production on location, post-production editing and graphics, as well as full DVD duplication services, WMHT.org. Spectrum 8 Theaters Albany, showing Hollywood, American, independent, and foreign films. Their Ultraviolet Cafe is next door for before or after the show. Open daily, Spectrum8.com. New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners, working to reduce youth and adult smoking rates across the state and help save lives. New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners at smokefreecapital.org. At Adventure Outfitters, Hadley, Massachusetts, offering outdoor clothing, camping equipment, cross-country skis, snowshoes, climbing equipment, canoes, and kayaks. Open evenings until 9. AdventureOutfitter.com. Thanks to Zach Malloy and Stacey Perry for running the show. And thanks to Christy Carton for answering the phones. The news is next. Goodbye, everybody.